The golden age of radio is on the air. Morehead State Public Radio presents classic old-time radio programs from radio's golden age, the 1930s through the 1950s. On this program of the golden age of radio, Michael Redgrave stars in The Adventures of Horatio Hornblower, an episode of Buck Rogers in the 25th Century, and Paul Shannon is your host on Adventures in Research. Stay tuned for the golden age of radio after today's news from NPR on WMKY at 90.3 FM. Welcome back to the Golden Age of Radio on WMKY at 90.3 FM. Later on today's show, an episode of Buck Rogers in the 25th Century, and Paul Shannon profiles the Adventure of Ice on Adventures in Research. Right now, Michael Redgrave stars in The Adventures of Horatio Hornblower as WMKY presents the Golden Age of Radio.
Call all hands, speak to quarters. Stand by the starboard battery.
One broadside into it, if you please, Captain Bush.
Pointers on target. Linstocks ready.
Aye, aye, sir. Ready.
Fire.
Presenting Michael Redgrave as C.S. Forrester's Indomitable Man of the Sea, Horatio Hornblower.
Start of that one was the most miserable and distressing. My ship was seriously undermanned. I was suffering from the seasickness which always attacked me at the beginning of a voyage. My mind was torn between anxiety for my wife Maria, who would be having our baby before my return, and misery at the marriage of Lady Barbara Wellesley. And now I was saddled with the care of six fat, stupid, lubberly merchant ships. As I stood on my quarterdeck in the gray dawn with the wind whipping through the rigging, I cursed those Indiamen for their slowness in acknowledging my signals.
They must man those Indiamen with blockades, sir. The Lord Mornington's been flying that signal at the dip for 10 minutes.
Well, they haven't the sense to clear the halyards.
Oh, well.
I've given them their course for Finisterre, and they must follow it as best they can. I shall go below, Mr. Bush.
Aye, aye, sir. One moment, sir.
What's that?
Something's happening. The warmer castles hold her wind. Look, sir. You can see her through the glass.
Yes, she's spun round. She's clawing up to windward towards us. Surely she's signaling. Where's the signals, Lieutenant?
Here, sir. It's a jumble signal. I can't read it.
What?
Looks like number 29, sir.
Huh?
But it can't be. That means discontinue the action. And now she's hauled it down. Well, there goes another. It's number 11.
Yeah.
Number 11, sir. That means enemy in sight.
Master there! What can you see on the port bow?
Nothing, only the warmer castle, sir.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I can see them now, sir. Two luggers on the port bow.
Luggers, eh? That can only mean privateers, sir. If they can pick off an East Indiaman, it'll be a feather in their caps.
Then we shall prevent them from feathering their caps. Hands to quarters, Mr. Bush.
Aye, aye, sir. Hands to quarters!
We shall need our wits about us, Mr. Bush. It's going to be difficult. They will maneuver to cut off a ship to windward of us.
Lay alongside a quarter while we're beating up against the wind.
That's it.
Those luggers are as quick as lightning in stays.
The Indiaman are so slow and our crew is so raw. There are two luggers. We shall have to parry two thrusts at once.
You can see it plainly now, sir. Two masters. They have about 20 guns apiece, 9-pounders. We could blow them out of the water if they were fools enough to come in close range. I'd say they carry about 150 men each, and all meant for gold.
Yes, have the guns loaded and run out, Mr. Bush.
Aye, aye, sir.
Run out the guns!
That's the leading lugger, sir. Didn't see where a shot went.
Helm a starboard.
Starboard, sir.
Meter steady.
Steady, sir.
Look at the wall of castle sheering off. She'll run into the next ship in a minute. Can we reach her in time?
Yes, we're too close now for the luggers to dare.
Ah,
I thought so. They're swinging away to avoid our broadside.
Back to main topsail.
We must keep to windward of the convoy so that we can dash down to any danger point.
Let the convoy get ahead again.
Hello, sir. What are they up to now, sir? They're leading the convoy.
Yes, they're going to swing round presently and attack the starboard ship. Clap on sail. We must intercept. Yes, there they go. They're after the Lord Mornington.
Hard aport.
Hard aport.
They're going to switch to the warmer castle, or I'm a Dutchman.
Yes, I thought so. Ah, you thought ahead of them there, sir. We cut them off again. If only the Indiaman had the sense not to scatter. Once they break up, we'll never get to the threatened one in time. Hello. What's the game now?
Well, they've thought up some plan, I imagine. They're working astern of us. Yes, I think I see their intention. They're going to diverge.
Yes. Here they come, sir. One to starboard, one to port.
Yes.
They're going to attack both wings of the convoy at once.
Uh-huh.
We'll never get across from one to the other in time.
We must. There's no alternative. The starboard lugger is slightly nearer. We'll tackle her first. Starboard, 2 points.
Starboard, 2 points.
We'll cross the lugger's bows on this course. She'll have to edge away to avoid our broadside, and that'll keep her off the convoy.
Well, what about the other one, sir? This course is taking us away from the convoy.
Can't help that. Our only hope is to get back in time. We've edged this one away at least.
The second lugger, sir. She's attacking the warmer castle to port.
Hands to the braces. Hard to starboard.
Aye, aye.
Bring her down, Mr. Bush, quickly.
Shrouds and all. Shall we go in and finish her, sir?
Certainly not, Mr. Bushart. The job is to guard the convoy. Square away on the other tack. We must deal with the other one before she can attack us on the other side.
Hands to braces! Lively there! Goodbye, Mr. Froggy. You have a long day's work ahead of you before you can see Brest again.
The convoy was frantically beating up towards us again, with the second privateer on their heels, like a dog after a flock of sheep. But at the sight of the Sutherland rushing down upon her, she sheered off again. Obviously, she worked round to make a dash at one of the outside ships, but I swung the Sutherland round and headed her off. Thus it went on, for an hour or more, like a game of hide-and-seek. But with only one lugger to deal with, my task was easier. At last, the Frenchman realized that he was wasting his time. His big lugsail came round, and he thrashed away to windward in search of his crippled colleague.
He's off, sir. We'll have no more trouble with those two.
No, Mr. Bush, but the captain of that second lugger is a fool. If he left his consort to look after itself and hung on to us until nightfall, he'd be almost sure to pick off one of our ships in the darkness. There. Yes, you can secure the guns now.
Aye, aye, sir. Secure the guns, Mr. Jeddah!
What are those idiots cheering about? From the noise they're making, you'd think they'd won Trafalgar. Mr. Bush, stop that noise at once. Send the hands aft. I'll speak to them.
Not much bigger than our longboat. Two broadsides from 74 guns, and you're pleased with yourselves for knocking away a single spar.
Half the trouble with the men is that we haven't enough old hands to lead them to the right ropes.
It's the same with my guns, sir. I got 74 of them and no more than 50 trained gun layers.
I know.
I'll train them in time, sir, but half my gunners couldn't hit a three-decker at point-blank range.
I know. By heaven, I'll get some more men before this voyage is much older if I have to land in France and seize Frenchmen. Strong nor-easterly wind had not only hurried my convoy to the North African latitude where I was to leave them, but had also prevented all intercourse and visiting between ships. But now the wind had dropped to a gentle breeze. The Sutherland was slipping slowly along with a westerly breeze abeam. The six East Indiamen were clustered together only a few cables' length to leeward. Even before Gerard reported, I had marked the approach of a boat from the Lord Mornington. Had nerved myself for the inevitable polite call. As the visitors came aboard, I saw that the man in the formal frock coat was Captain Osborne of the Lord Mornington. His companion was resplendent in full civilian dress with ribbon and star.
Good afternoon, Captain Hornblower. I would like to present to you Lord Eastlake, Governor-designate of Bombay.
This is a great pleasure, Your Lordship.
The pleasure is mine, Captain. I have come to beg of you to accept, on behalf of your ship's company, this purse of 400 guineas.
400 guineas?
Sir, it has been subscribed by the passengers of the East India convoy in recognition of the skill and the courage displayed by the Sutherland in action with two French privateers.
Well, this is most generous and totally undeserved, sir. Nevertheless, I greatly appreciate your kindness, and on behalf of my ship's company, I thank your lordship.
And I, sir, am the bearer of a most cordial invitation to you and your first lieutenant to join us at dinner in the Lord Mornington.
Oh, thank you for your courtesy, sir. I deeply regret that I must decline the invitation, but we part company in 2 hours.
Well, that is a pity, Captain Hornblower. Cannot you be persuaded?
Oh, my lord, I'm on the King's service and under the most explicit orders from the Admiral.
Well, in that case, Captain, I understand. But at least you will allow me to meet some of your officers.
Begging your pardon, sir, but there's no need to turn all that money over to us and the men. You could treat it as prize money and take your share under prize rules.
Thank you, Mr. Bush, but I can't accept that sort of reward from civilians. However, the crew must show appreciation. Man the yards and have the men give three cheers as Lord Eastlake's boat pulls away.
Aye, aye, sir. Man the yards!
Man the yards!
Now then, men. Lord Eastlake has brought you a present for saving the convoy. Three cheers for his lordship!
Mr. Bush?
Sir?
Mr. Gerard, your attention over here, please. Now, listen, I'm desperately short of men. I'm going to take some from those East Indiamen.
But, sir, they're John Company's ships. Their men are exempt from pressing, sir.
Nobody's exempt when the King's service needs him. I'm aware that I'm contravening Admiralty orders, but I plead necessity.
Now, will you excuse me, sir, if I point out that John Company is the most powerful corporation in England? It might be a bad policy to offend them, sir.
I'll be a judge of my policy, Mr. Gerard, and I'll take the responsibility. You will obey orders.
Aye, sir.
Those ships will sight no land until they reach St. Helena. It'll be 3 or 4 months before any protest can reach England, and a further 6 months before any censure can reach me in the Mediterranean. It's possible that in 6 months we shall all be dead.
Thank you, sir.
Give the boat's crews pistols and cutlasses, just to show that I'll stand no nonsense. I want 20 men from each of those ships.
20 from each, sir? That's flouting the law on the grand scale, sir.
That's the only sensible scale on which to flout the law, Mr. Bush.
Captain Hornblower, this is an outrage, sir, and I must protest against it. At this very moment, your lieutenant is parading my crew with a view to impressment.
He's acting by my orders, sir.
But I can hardly believe it, sir. Well, are you aware that this is a flagrant violation of Admiralty regulations? A perfect outrage, sir. The ships of the Honorable East India Company are exempt from impressment, and I, as Commodore, must protest to the last breath of my body against any contravention of the law.
I shall be glad to receive your protest when you make it, sir.
When I make it? But I have delivered it, sir. I have made my protest.
But will you not allow me to ask for volunteers from among your crew, Captain? There may be a few men who'd like to join the King's service.
Oh, I cannot imagine, sir, that many men will be foolish enough to exchange the comfort of the East India Company's service for the rigours of a ship of the line. But, yes, I would agree even to that.
Thanks.
Your seamanship in the affair with the privateers was so admirable that, frankly, I find it hard to refuse you anything.
That's very good of you, sir. Allow me to escort you to your gig. I will recall my boats. Since they will have taken the volunteers first, we can rely on it that they have all the willing ones on board, and I shall return the unwilling ones. Thank you, Captain Osborne. Thank you.
He calmed down wonderfully, sir. Pity we had to give way. But we might get a few volunteers out of that lot, sir.
I feel sure we shall, Mr. Woods.
Here's the launch of the cutter coming back, sir. They're both loaded with men to the gunwale, sir. They're passing Captain Osborne's gig now.
Mm-hmm.
He's waving and shouting something to them.
Mr. Gerard and Mr. Raynard are very properly paying no attention to him. Stand by. The men will be coming aboard very shortly.
Silence down there! The captain will address you.
Now listen to me, men. You're probably a bit bewildered at your sudden change of circumstances, but let me assure you that the entry port through which you've just passed is a gateway to glory.
Yeah, we know what sort of glory.
Yeah, we do.
Have the man's blood, or raises his voice, or interrupts again. For 17 years, your country's been struggling with the Corsican tyrant. Your ease and comfort has been possible only because of the loyalty and courage of the brave men who've manned British men of war. Now you have the opportunity of joining that gallant company. But you've got other opportunities, too. The chance of prize money. The convoy from which you've come presented my crew with 400 guineas for their work in saving you from the French privateers. And there's more, much more, to be made by willing men on the East Coast by the taking of French prizes. You'll serve your country and yourselves at the same time. No man is treated harshly on my ship unless he deserves harshness. You're here, and it's in your hands now whether your lives go well or ill. And what I do in the name of His Majesty the King. That's all. Guard, march these men down to the main deck. Mr. Bush, have the goodness to go down and read the articles of war to them.
Aye, aye, sir.
Aye,
bold step, but the necessities of war demanded boldness. I now had nearly a full complement of crew with these 120, most of them able seamen. By the time Bush returned from reading the men into the service, the boats were inboard and we were all ready to square away. Mr. Vincent, signal to the convoy. All men have volunteered. Thank you. Goodbye.
All men have volunteered. Thank you. Goodbye. Aye, aye, sir.
I beg your pardon, sir, but what will you say to the Admiralty?
I shall tell them that I took the men with the permission of the Commodore. I did, too. He said I could keep any men who volunteered.
Yes, sir, but not many did, really.
You know seamen as well as I do, Bush. It'll be a year before we get back to England, and in that time I shall be surprised if I don't convince most of them that they did volunteer. We only want a bit of luck and a few prizes, and those fellows will swear to anything.
It's a master stroke, sir. And the Admiralty will be reluctant to prosecute. They know as well as we do how necessary seamen are.
Signals gone, sir. The Lord Mornington is replying.
Ah, what does she say?
Captain Osborne to Captain Hornblower. Do not understand your signal.
Await boat.
Thank you.
Is that all sail? Hands for braces. Square away there. Mr. Vincent, hoist another signal, please. Just one word.
Aye, aye, sir. Which word, sir?
Goodbye.
Horatio Hornblower, starring Michael Redgrave, is based on the novels by C.S. Forrester. Music composed and conducted by Sidney Torch. Produced by Harry Allen Towers.
Listening to the Golden Age of Radio on WMKY and an episode of The Adventures of Horatio Hornblower starring Michael Redgrave. Stay tuned for more classic old-time radio from the 1930s through the 1950s. When the Golden Age of Radio continues on Morehead State Public Radio, WMKY at 90.3 FM. Welcome back to the Golden Age of Radio on WMKY at 90.3 FM. In a moment, Paul Shannon profiles the King of Ice on Adventures and Research. Right now, here's an episode of Buck Rogers in the 25th Century as WMKY presents the Golden Age of Radio.
Buck Rogers in the 25th Century.
Buck Rogers is back on the air. Buck and Wilma and all their fascinating friends and mysterious enemies in the super scientific 25th century. This program is brought to you by the makers of Popsicle, Fudgicle, and Creamsicle, those delicious frozen confections on a stick. Now I have a swell surprise for you. The famous winner of the typical American boy contest has now become Popsicle Pete. Here's a message from him.
Hello, everybody. I sure am glad to meet you. And boy, am I glad I was picked to be the typical American boy, because now I'm Popsicle Pete. I always wanted to be on the radio. Now I have a chance to tell you about some wonderful presents you can get free. Gee, you ought to see them. Hundreds of them. You get them just for saving bags from Nifty Popsicle, Fudgicle, and Creamsicle. Some gifts, even better than Christmas. You can get a wristwatch, a movie camera, table tennis, a wallet, a doll. Gee, lots of gifts. Just save the bags from Popsicle, Creamsicle, and Fudgicle on a handy stick. Boy, do they taste good.
Wholesome, too. And nourishing. Made fresh every day of the finest ingredients. The biggest 5 cents worth anywhere.
And say, kids, get the free illustrated Popsicle gift list at your ice cream store. A free coupon comes with it, worth 10 bags.
And now for Buck Rogers and his thrilling adventures 500 years in the future. As you probably know, Buck was born right here in our own times, in this 20th century. And the story of how he got started on his amazing adventures so far in the future is mighty interesting. But instead of telling you about it, let's turn the dial that'll project us ahead in time and find out all about it that way. Now, the capital of 25th century America is Niagara. And there it is that Dr. Huer, the great scientist, has his marvelous laboratory. In one room of it, he's working on a strange-looking device that sends a peculiar greenish light down onto a human figure lying on a table before him. Shall we join him there? Okay, then, here we go, 500 years into the future.
The ray is putting you to sleep. To sleep. Relax and sleep. 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 Good. The ray's had its effect. Now I can go ahead. Yes, come in. Oh, hello, Wilma.
Hello, Dr. Huer. Hi, why don't you have more light in here? Coming in from outside, I can hardly see a thing in this spooky greenish glow.
Part of a little experiment I'm conducting.
Oh.
But tell me, have you seen anything of Black Barney here in Niagara?
Why, no. Hasn't given up his job of Prime Minister on Mars, has he?
Oh, no, no. But one of his Martian rocket ship factories has worked out a new control device for me. I rather hoped he'd get here with it today.
Oh.
Meantime, I've made ready for a final test of this little invention here. Like to stay and see it?
I'd love to, Doctor, and you know it, but I just dropped in to find out if you've seen any sign of... Oh.
What's the matter?
Doctor, what's happened to him?
Eh?
Is he all right? Doctor!
I see.
What's happened to him? Why is he lying here on the table?
Don't worry, Wilma.
Don't worry? Doctor, what are you...
He is offered to be the subject of my test, that's all.
But then, why is he...
simply lying here, comfortably asleep, under the influence of my electrohypnotic ray.
Oh. I was afraid something had happened to him.
Not a thing. Surely you don't think for a minute that I'd do anything
to... No, of course not. But the electrohypnotic ray, are you sure this experiment won't hurt him in any way?
Oh, absolutely sure.
Well, you can't blame me for being a little shocked for a minute. But what's that thing up near his head that looks like a miniature power plant with a loudspeaker on top of it?
That, Wilma, is my latest scientific achievement. My newly perfected electrohypnomentalophone.
Your what?
Well, you remember the mentaloscope, don't you?
Sure. When you put a person under the mentaloscope, all his memories showed up on a sort of moving picture screen.
That's right. And this is an adaptation of it.
Oh.
With this, the electrohypnomentalophone, the memories of the subject will come to us verbally, through the loudspeaker here. Provided, of course, that my calculations have been correct.
Sort of read a person's mind aloud, you mean?
Yes, yes, that's it exactly.
Where do you ever get ideas for things like this, Dr. Huer? Surely people don't just barge in and ask you to work them out.
Hardly. The scientific research and experimentation that led up to the development of this machine was started way back in the 20th century.
Why, I always thought that the people back in the 20th century weren't much better than savages in what they knew about scientific things.
Oh, not at all, Wilma. Oh, we owe a great deal to the scientists of those days. Were it not for the groundwork laid by men like Einstein, Fitzgerald, Compton, Millikan, and the rest, we'd be without a great many of the things we have today.
They never really got anywhere with rocket ship development or anything like that, though, did they?
Well, successful rocket flight depends on two things that have been brought into existence only recently.
One of them must be inertron.
Yes, inertron. The material that defies gravity and makes it possible to lift a big spaceship off the Earth and away from its terrific gravitational pull without too much waste of power.
And what's the other?
Impervium. The only metal capable of withstanding the high temperature of rocket blasts for any length of time.
Oh.
But now, let's go ahead with this experiment.
Yes, let's. And you can tell me how this apparatus works as we go along, and just what it does to them.
Well, not very much to tell you about the apparatus itself, Wilma. Except that here, in this little pad under his head, is an extremely sensitive and high-frequency response piezoelectric oscillator of quite complicated design.
Yes, I guess so.
Yes. And I've succeeded in tuning it to receive the minute electronic impulses that emanate from his brain.
Yeah.
Through the medium of a super-radiating protonoformer.
Oh, what?
In other words, we're able to obtain sufficient amplification of the impulse output to register audibly through a process of thermionic note magnification. That's all there is to it.
I think I'll understand it better when I see this thing work.
I should be very much disappointed if it doesn't.
Oh, don't you worry about that, Doctor. Your inventions always work.
I have been rather lucky in most of my experiments, haven't I?
Lucky?
Well, now let's proceed with this one.
All right. Anything I can do to help?
No, thanks. First of all, we'll have to switch in the electroniformer.
Is the electroniformer a sort of eerie sound?
Yes. And now, when I switch on this microphone and speak to him, my words will be registered directly on his brain. Not through his ears, you understand, but directly on his brain.
Uh-huh.
And if we're successful, we'll receive his subconscious response through the loudspeaker.
Go ahead, Doctor.
Now, young man, what is your name? I said, what is your name?
Buck Rogers.
Wilma, it works.
But, Doctor...
My invention's a success.
But Doctor, what happened?
It works even better than I thought it would.
He didn't move his lips, though. And how could we hear him talk if he didn't move his lips?
It read his mind aloud, Wilma. It read his mind aloud.
It sounded like his real voice, though.
Well, of course. Because he thinks of speech in the same manner that he utters it.
Great day. It doesn't seem possible. Ask him some more questions.
Yes. Yes, by all means. Listen. Buck, you were born back in the 20th century, were you not?
Yes, sir. But this is the 25th century.
You see, Wilma, his memory's preserved intact.
May I ask him a question?
Surely. Go ahead. Go ahead.
Buck, how did you happen to come to the 25th century?
One day in the year 1919, I was in the lower workings of an abandoned mine near the city of Pittsburgh.
Yes?
All of a sudden, the supports that held up the walls and ceiling gave way and the whole thing caved in on me.
Yes?
Some kind of peculiar gas was released. It put me to sleep. It kept me in a state of suspended animation for 500 years. Then the ground shifted and let in fresh air, and I woke up.
Well, how did you know you were in suspended animation for 500 years?
Instead of the year 1919, it was the year 24-something. To be exact, it was 24...
How did you know what year it was?
I was told about it by Lieutenant Wilma Deering, a beautiful girl soldier I met when I first did.
Oh, then you knew Wilma Deering.
Well, I certainly do. She's the finest and bravest girl who ever lived. Why, Wilma...
Buck Rogers?
Yes?
Did you find anything new and different when you first came into the 25th century?
Oh, a great deal, thanks to Dr. Hewer.
Dr. Hewer?
The greatest scientist who ever lived.
What's this?
Nowhere in the universe is there a scientist who's done so much good for humanity or done anything that can even...
Wait a minute, Buck.
Yes?
Just forget Dr. Hewer and go on with what you were saying.
But he's the man who invented the first rocket ship that took us to the moon. And it was that trip that proved the practicability of interplanetary flight.
Practicability of interplanetary flight? Nothing wrong with this machine, Doctor.
Where else have you gone by rocket ship, Buck?
First to Mars, where we helped King and Aldo put down an invasion by the Martian tiger men.
Yes?
Then to Saturn and the Saturnian moon, Venus, Jupiter, and even far-off Pluto.
Which planet did you find most interesting?
Well, that's hard to say. Jupiter has the biggest field for exploration simply because it's so much larger than the rest of the planets.
Very true. Do you expect to do any more rocketing around through outer space?
Well, there's nothing else I'd rather do, sir.
Well, Wilma, you like my little contraption?
Oh, it's wonderful, Doctor. I told you it would work.
Well, is there anything else you'd like to ask Buck before I turn off this green ray?
Let's wake him up and see if he remembers anything that happened during the experiment.
All right. Go ahead.
All right. Come on, Buck. Wake up.
Huh?
I say, wake up. You've been asleep.
Asleep?
Uh-huh.
Oh, hello, Wilma.
Hello.
Hey, where'd you come from? What are you doing here?
I've just been let in on the test of Dr. Hewer's
electro-hypno-mentalophone.
Yeah.
Oh, and doggone it. Instead of helping you with your test, I fell asleep. Say, I'm awfully sorry, Doctor.
Sorry?
Oh, yes, sir. I was going
to
help
you. But, I put you to sleep with this machine.
Oh, really?
Right.
Well, I guess that's one on me, then. How did it work?
Even better than I expected.
Oh, good.
Oh, it was marvelous, Buck. You told us your whole life history without even opening your mouth.
Hey, now, wait a minute.
it's all right, Buck. You didn't say a single thing you shouldn't have.
Oh, thank goodness for that. Let's put Wilma under it.
Oh, no, you don't.
Oh, you have to do something for excitement around here. Come on, Wilma.
Oh, you're never satisfied unless there's something exciting going on, are you, Buck?
Well, it's not as bad as all that, Doctor, but things have been sort of slow around here lately. And
wait until we start making tests of the new type of gyrocosmic relative aid I've just devised.
A new one?
Isn't that the equipment on a rocket ship that makes it possible to take off without much loss of time for pickup?
That's right. And without the usual physical effects of too quick acceleration. It removes from your ship the normal effects of weight and inertia and momentum and the like.
Well, how have you improved the relative aid, Doctor?
Huck, if this new instrument does what I hope it will, there'll be practically no limit to the speed of a rocket ship immediately upon taking off.
Good night. Imagine getting into the control cabin, opening the power lever, and going a couple of thousand miles an hour just like that.
That's exactly what we'll be able to do, Wilma.
Boy, that hardly seems possible, does it? But when can we test it out, Doctor? Have you already got it installed on a rocket ship?
No, Buck. As a matter of fact, I don't even have it yet.
Huh?
Oh, it's been made up all right. The one we use for the test, but it isn't right here yet.
I don't understand, Doctor.
Well, yes, sir. Can't we get it here? The sooner we can get it and start trying it out, the sooner we can break the monotony of just sitting around here
Wait.
Doing...
Wait, Buck. Listen.
Yes, Doctor. I hear it, too.
Well, yeah.
Hear it?
Yes, sir. But what under the sun is it?
Look here, out of the window.
Look, heaven's Wilma. And it's coming right down this way. Wilma!
Oh!
Say, Buck's wish for excitement certainly came true in a hurry. Great day. I wonder what that was. And I certainly hope he and Wilma and Dr. Hewer are all right. What do you say, Pete?
Well, I know what would make me feel all right. A great big frozen fudgicle. Jiminy, can you imagine anything better than that fresh, creamy chocolate fudge frozen ice cold on a stick?
Fellas and girls, what's the best, purest, biggest nickel's worth you can get? Right, a fudgicle. Delicious and full of healthful energy. Made only from pure milk products. Swell to eat and easy to digest. And don't forget to save the bags for those wonderful free prizes. Exciting gifts like cameras, dolls, sweatshirts, gorgeous jewelry, and lots of other things.
Now listen, kids. Be sure to get your free popsicle gift list at your ice cream store. Don't take no for an answer.
Adventures in Research. We do take a lot of things for granted. Water, air, earth, sun, ice. Well now, ice. Perhaps you never heard of the man who invented ice. This is Paul Shannon bringing you another transcribed story of science produced as a public service in cooperation with the Westinghouse Research Laboratories. And today telling you the story of the Ice King, as he liked to be called. And he also liked to think he invented ice. This notion seemed absurd to the New Englanders at the dawn of the 19th century. Invent ice? With lakes, rivers, and streams frozen over? When part of any winter's work was sawing out blocks of the solid stuff.
Come on, Tom. Let's keep moving. Gosh, it's cold.
Well, ain't that enough?
How much of the consigned stuff does Martha need anyhow?
Oh, just enough to store in the cellar. Now, one more block ought to do it. Steve, do!
While such scenes were common in the northernmost states, a young chap named Frederick Tudor of Boston found the winter months more pleasant on a ship headed for the West Indies.
Ah, there, Tudor. Another fine day for sailing. Ocean smooth as glass, eh?
Indeed. Oh, it's like a different world. When I think of the poor souls up in Boston and New England. Fetch more wood, Frederick. Get out the snow shovel, Frederick. Heat the bricks for the bed, Frederick. Oh, this is the life. Warm sun, no winter clothes.
For a young chap, you've done quite well for yourself, Tudor. Don't mind my asking, but just what do you do the rest of the year?
Oh, work in a Boston shipping firm. Started when I was 13. Oh, been there for 8 years. 8 years of cold winters and ice and snow.
Well, see, you've left that far behind. Wait till you see the West Indies. The captain says we'll be putting into port this afternoon about sundown.
Sure.
Care to debark and see the place, Tudor?
Fine.
Sure is warm, isn't it? I've been doing little else but mop my brow. I don't mind it being warm, but a man can get baked in this climate, too, you know.
Yes, but I love it. Oh, how about joining me in some ginger tea? That should cool you off.
Cool you off? Man, you're mad. It's warm.
Well, it doesn't have to be. Up home in the summers, we chip some ice from the ice cellar and...
Ice? We left that back there, boy. Ice. These people never saw ice, never heard of it, and wouldn't believe it if you showed it to them.
Well, that's right. I forgot. Imagine living all your life and not knowing what ice is.
Yeah. I think I'll go below deck. That sun will have me baked to a crisp.
Next time I come back, I'll have to bring my own ice with me.
Back in his native Boston, young Tudor approached his father with a peculiar request.
Dad, you know that pond you own up in Saugus?
Uh-huh. What about it?
Well, I wondered if I might be able to use it.
Use it? Well, it's pretty well fished out. Just a few miles out of Boston. Yeah, and the city is growing, so...
I don't want it for fishing. I want the ice.
Yeah, in a few years... You want the what?
The ice. When it freezes over this winter.
Well, I don't see why not. Welcome to it, son. You going to build another ice cellar? Go right ahead, lad. Take all of it you want.
Thank you, Dad.
Frederick, you're welcome to it, of course. Take all the ice in the pond. But what do you intend to do with it? Not that it's any of my business, of course, but then...
Well, thanks again, Dan.
Frederick, as I say, it's none of my affair. The ice is there for the taking. What you want with it is your own concern.
Well, of course.
I mean, well, hang it, son. What are you going to do with a whole pond full of ice? That is... Well, now, mind you, I know you have a good reason for it, I'm sure, but then...
Well, I do, Dad. I'm going to take the ice down to the West Indies.
I see. Well, I knew you'd have a sound, sensible, sane... You what?
Yes, Frederick Tudor was going to bring ice to the equator. With hardly enough cash to pay for cutting the ice, he managed to charter a ship, and in the winter of 1805... sent two helpers down to the port of Saint-Pierre in Martinique to prepare for the arrival. In March of 1806, Frederick Tudor arrived in Martinique on a ship whose hold was filled with 130 tons of ice packed in hay.
Excuse me, you speak English?
Oui, I speak English, little.
Have you seen a couple of Americans, a Mr. Armitage, a Mr. Westland?
Je ne sais pas.
Oh, a tall man, short man, my friends, supposed to meet me here. Meet me here. Ice. They talk of ice. In boat. Boat. Ice.
No.
Let me put it this way. American money?
American money. Oui. They be at Tivoli Garden. Yes. They spend, laugh, drink. Oui. They gone.
Tivoli Gardens?
Oui. Tivoli Garden. Over there. See? It's a Tivoli.
Thanks.
Merci, monsieur. Merci. Merci, monsieur.
Are you the proprietor?
Oui, monsieur. Giovanni Tivoli. At your service, monsieur.
I'm looking for some countrymen of mine from the States. I understand they were here.
I look for them, too. They leave Giovanni. They say, we see you, Giovanni. Goodbye, Giovanni.
Well,
pay you later, Giovanni. For 2 weeks, Giovanni, wait. I cannot afford to lose such money. They your friend? You pay their bill, huh?
I'm afraid not. They left me holding the bag, too.
What bag?
I have a cargo aboard my ship in the harbor, and they were supposed to...
You bring in cargo from the States,
yes,
Michelle?
And something has to be done quickly. With this sun beating down, in no time it'll all...
Oh, of course. Sun no good for food, monsieur. Sun spoil it soon.
Not spoil it, melt it.
Such funny words you use in States, monsieur. We say food spoil. You say food melt?
Melt. But it isn't food, it's ice, and it's very...
I am sure, nice, very nice.
Not nice, ice, I-C-E, ice.
Oh, to be sure, monsieur, oui, ice, I-C-E, ice, n'est-ce pas?
Yes, ice.
Ice, oui. What is ice?
Well, it's the, well, when it freezes, you, well... Water becomes...
Water. You like glass of water, monsieur? Of course. Hey, there you are, monsieur. Water. Complimente Tivoli Gardens.
A very nice establishment you have here.
Like in the States, no, monsieur? Just like in the States?
Well, sort of. Of course, in the States, we have ice.
Tivoli Gardens, as good as States, monsieur. Nothing you have there that Giovanni does not have here.
Well, you lack just one thing.
Eh?
If you had that, then indeed your Tivoli Gardens would be as great as any American restaurant.
What do we not have? Giovanni has everything. Look, coffee, tea, a home-baked cake, monsieur.
But where is your ice?
Ice?
Ice.
In States, monsieur. Every place has this ice.
Wouldn't dream of opening without it. Unheard of.
Tivoli Gardens, as good as any place. I, too, can have ice. You say you have a shipload of this ice in harbor, monsieur?
Oh, I do, but... I've already promised it to...
Promise? Bah! I buy this ice. I pay double. You sell to me, eh?
Well, you're a hard businessman, Giovanni. all right, I'll sell you the ice.
Good, monsieur. One question, monsieur. Now I have the ice. What do I do with it?
Why, you can make ice cream with it.
Oh, ice cream? Oui, of course. Ice cream. what is this ice cream?
You never heard of ice cream?
Never, monsieur.
Well, you will, Giovanni, and all Martinique will.
Eh?
You have some milk, sugar, flavorings?
Here,
take my coat.
Monsieur.
I'll start in making some ice cream right now, and by tomorrow, Tivoli Gardens will be the talk of Martinique.
On the first night, Tivoli Gardens sold more than $300 worth of ice cream, and the customers crowded the place. The local newspaper hailed the event.
This remarkable epoch in the history of luxury and enterprise began March 6, 1806, when ice creams were eaten for the first time in the settlement of the country lying just 14 degrees north of the equator.
And though the bringing of ice to Martinique might be hailed as a social success, financially, Tudor lost almost $3,500 due to the melting of the ice. But he tried it again, this time in 1815 in Havana, where startled natives saw the construction of a strange building.
Mamma mia, he say it is an ice house.
An ice house it was, with double partitions and dead space between the walls and heavy plank flooring. In the floor, gutters were embedded like eaves spouts, which caught the melted ice and conveyed it to a barrel outside. At the barrel, Frederick Tudor stood with a watch in his hand.
Hours up. Runoff amounts to 56 pounds. Now, that's too much. We'll need more hay to cover the ice. Better. 33 pounds in an hour. but not good enough. We'll bank earth around the building and try that. 18 pounds. We can't do much better than that.
But Tudor was still not completely satisfied. His shipments increased, his fleet enlarged. But what could he do to preserve the ice? Hay was not enough. He tried tan bark, chaff, wheat, pulverized cork, even coal dust, until he hit upon another item of New England waste, pine sawdust. With the help of that and new special tools, augers, tongs, picaroons, his ice exports jumped from 4,000 tons a year to 65,000 tons. He sent apples to the tropics, brought tropical fruits to the States, and was soon recognized as the ice king of the world. 4 years before his death in 1864, he had the satisfaction of seeing his ships carrying ice to 53 ports all over the world. And the last glimpse we have of the ice king is at 80, as he stands at a frosted window in the cold he so despised, watching the weather and remarking,
"The frost covers the window. The wheels creak. The boys run. Winter rules. And $50,000 worth of ice floats for me on fresh pond. Ice to cool the palates of the world that I might be warm."
The world has come far since the days of Frederick Tudor and his shiploads of ice. And in no respect has it progressed further than in the science of refrigeration. Today, modern electric refrigeration and ice-making methods have long since made Tudor's enterprise out of date. But his discovery of better insulation to protect his ice helped push forward the day when the ice itself would be unnecessary. An unusual result, indeed, to Frederick Tudor's equally strange adventure in research. And that's today's Adventures in Research, produced in cooperation with the Westinghouse Research Laboratories. These programs are broadcast to armed forces personnel overseas through the facilities of the Armed Forces Radio Service. Join us again next week for another transcribed story of science on Adventures in Research.
The Golden Age of Radio on WMKY and Paul Shannon, your host for Adventures in Research from 1943. We also heard an episode of Buck Rogers in the 25th Century, first broadcast on radio on April 5th, 1939. This has been the Golden Age of Radio, classic old-time radio programs from the 1930s through the 1950s. Material for this program provided by the Internet Archive, an online nonprofit library of books, movies, music, and old-time radio shows on the web at archive.org. Tune in again for the Golden Age of Radio next week at the same time and channel on WMKY at 90.3 FM and online at WMKY.org.